Thanks for joining us on another Storage Unpacked podcast. This week, we're talking to Chris Wall from Rubrik. Chris is their tech evangelist, has been there about 18 months. The company's about 3 years old, and we're going to talk about secondary storage and the future of backup. Hey, Chris.
What's up? How's it going?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Fantastic. Because it's still daytime for me. It's night for y'all, so...
That is true. So very quickly, I'll let you introduce yourself in a moment. But just for everybody else listening, we've got Gavin. Hey, Gavin.
Hey, Chris. Hey, guys.
And we've got Martin.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
So almost a full house if we had the other Chris, but we haven't. So he's, as usual, what do we call him? He's our presenter emeritus. Is that the right term?
Presenter Scarlet Pimpernel, I like to call him. We seek him here, we seek him there.
But not
until
but
there's
not
some bad news, and then he'll get it in the press.
Exactly. So, Chris, why don't you give us a bit of background about yourself for everybody who's listening? I can't believe there is a single person listening to this podcast who does not know who you are. But just in case there is, you could give us a little bit of extra background.
Well, I just want to comment, we do have a redundant number of Chris's, so we're covered from a protection perspective. We can lose one, and we're okay.
But that's true.
Yeah, hi, I'm Chris Wall. So like you said, tech evangelist at Rubrik for about a year and a half. I run a website called wallnetwork.com, which is all about techie stuff for my fellow nerds. And I host a podcast with Ethan Banks called The Data Knots on the Packet Pushers site. So we talk about busting IT silos because most of enterprise IT made us sad for years and years. So we're kind of... It's like self-therapy in podcast format. And you can find me on Twitter at Chris Wall.
Excellent. Do you have to talk to Greg Farrow when you do those at all? Or are you quite lucky and you only have to talk to Ethan?
He's been on once in a while. I mean, I talk to him on Slack a lot. But no, it's really Ethan and I, or we'll have one or two guests on to pick apart, you know, storage, network, compute, whatever, and try to figure out how we can bust these silos that we've been working in forever.
Okay. So we're here today to talk about secondary storage. And obviously, that's an area Rubrik plays in. Why don't you give us an idea or tell everybody what you think the definition of secondary storage is, and then we can all pitch in and give you our opinion about it.
Can I be real frank about secondary storage?
Absolutely.
Oh, please do. Spend. Please do. Cut through everything.
I really hate that pairing of words. I don't necessarily agree with that kind of label. I mean, I imagine the intention is that it's not running your production data. You know, it's a secondary place for data. It was the intent of it, but it's a very limiting type of mindset because you're really just talking about storage. It's not running production. That also is kind of a mind game because if you have a file server that's not hosting production files, but you're still using them in some way, then it becomes production. Like your development servers, you probably have a lot of developers that are working on something. And if your secondary storage goes down for those people, that's a lot of money going out the window. So, I mean, the intent is it's not running production, but in reality, everything's production as long as there's people working on it. So
I was going to say, if it's not production, why are you doing it?
Oh. Yeah, exactly. And so I think the intent is around places where you can land backup data ultimately. So there's probably some smarts around data reduction and efficiency and some services around it. But I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of the term. I think it's kind of silly.
Do you think that's an industry problem? Is that something like, you know, software-defined storage is that it just gets abused and, you know, everyone goes, what the? Because there's about 36 different definitions.
I think backup storage didn't sound sexy enough and secondary storage makes it sound like it's number two on the list, you know, which is better than last on the list or something. I don't know. But yeah, like so I remember, actually, Chris, I think we were at an HP thing and they were talking about software-defined servers because you would configure them
right.
when they yeah. brought up. And I'm like, do you mean virtual machines? Like, what are we talking about here? How can everything be software-defined? Eventually, there's some hardware involved somewhere. So yeah, it's a little bit of marketing washing, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I guess we need a definition in order for people to understand. But let's just assume that it's the sort of data that we don't necessarily have in our primary databases and all that sort of stuff. But let's qualify it and say yeah. it covers, say, backup, test dev, archive. It covers those sort of uses, even though they might be classed by people as secondary, they're not really secondary because they're just as important in the IT industry as everything else is.
I tend to focus on a few characters or attributes of a system that might be like that. Typically, the data is immutable, right? You don't want it to be changed once it's in that system. You don't want it to be available to be altered. If you're doing a set of backups, you don't want someone to go in and just rip out a few of them or alter something. So in the case of Rubrik, it's immutable storage once it's in there. The only real option you have is to purge all of it in case you don't want the data anymore. But there's no way to like // get into it, you know, like a UNC path or something like that. And ultimately, there's a lot of services that are added to data that's stored. But you know, we're really not focused on storage as a thing per se. We just happen to offer some storage in an appliance form factor for people that need that in the data center for quick RTO. Everything's really about ingesting, cataloging, added services, putting data where it needs to go. To me, it's like the storage in the data center for temporary holding of data or even long form holding of data isn't that interesting. It's more like, what are you going to do with that data that I think is interesting?
What do you mean it's not that interesting? That's my life.
Well,
the jury rests, my lord.
Interesting in the term of like, it's just sitting there doing nothing. That's not interesting. You know, like it shouldn't just be an insurance policy. It should be actionable. You should be able to do things with it and gain value more than just, here's this pile of stuff, and if we ever need it, we hope we can restore it. You know, that's the non-interesting part to me.
So, Martin, you're saying your life is actually interesting?
All the stuff I do is interesting. Was my life interesting? Of course my life's interesting.
Absolutely, I'm sure it is. Great. So now we've not got a definition. Now we've got a bit of a definition that covers lots of different things. I think it's pretty clear that we're trying to, I think the immutable one is a good measure. We're trying to look after that type of data. I think that's a good definition that really sort of helps to clarify the type of data. But why do you think we're only getting to this now? Why are we only building these sort of solutions now? And obviously, I won't ask you to talk about the competition, but there are a number of other people that are in this part of the industry. So why is this only coming out now, do you think?
I don't know necessarily why the marketing term came out. I mean, the secondary storage, based on the characteristics of it, isn't new. You know, it's been around for a long time in my world. I mean, basically, what was it, early 2000s or so, we started using disk as a backup target, whereas prior it would just go straight to tape. Right, mm-hmm. So that was just an economical decision. So it's probably been around for over 10 years, but we haven't been calling it this cool secondary storage thing. And then always the thing that I tend to point to is the hardware arms race, you know, the folks at Intel and the cheaper disk technologies and whatnot, making it possible to build your own secondary storage appliances, buy software and lay it onto hardware, you know, things like that. So it's more interesting maybe from that perspective, but I really don't think it's all that new, right? Just as like storing things in a secondary manner, you know, non-production storage has been around with various backup storage targets for a while.
Well, I tend to agree with you. If you look at, I don't think it's new at all. I mean, what you're talking about has been around for an awful long time. I was thinking going back to the famous company, some of us know and love, Copan. Because they were a secondary storage. Yeah, they were definitely secondary storage from that point of view. Spin down. It was immutable most of the time because you couldn't get at it.
If you knew Copan, that's actually quite a clever in-joke there, isn't it? So for those who didn't know, Copan didn't spin all their disks up at the same time. They used to spin up, only a quarter of them up or something?
25%, yeah.
They couldn't spin them all up at the same time because the data center would probably blow up.
Interestingly, though, I think we're perhaps mixing storage and data a bit. And I wonder whether things like the APIs that are in virtualization and so on have allowed us to actually address the data more than we say perhaps have done in the past. And if you look at some of the earlier disk-based backup solutions, all they did was just store bits on, you know, on disk, whereas now we're actually looking at the actual data itself in a lot more detail.
Exactly. So that's where I think the new part of the equation comes in. You know, before I felt like all the conversations were around, are you fixed or variable length dedupe and what's your block? You know, like all these really technical specificities around the system that was really focused on just when I get data in, how do I write it? You know, and that was a lot of the details. How much can I squeeze out of this asset? And now it's more around, well, if I can address the data as itself, like as an object or a virtual machine or a file or a service, and bring it in and actually holistically look at it, not just in the appliance or in the storage itself, but where else can I put it? What can I do with it? And then wrapping all that with RESTful APIs, now I can do some pretty fun stuff. Like I can make sure that I can back up and recover data using secondary storage, whatever you want to call it, for on-premises, but I can also shovel that data to object store, to cloud targets, to MSPs, and follow the lifecycle of the data and interact with it using automation with those APIs. So that's where I spend most of my time because customers are looking to do things like that. They don't just want to put it off into the vault and never see it again and just hope they can restore for it. They want to test restores. They want to spin up copies of things and do regression testing. They want to mine the data for interesting tidbits. You know, they want to do something actionable. And so that's more of the space that I get excited about beyond just the storage itself.
So is that, Chris, you know, Rubik's differentiation? If, you know, if I was to say what stands you out in the marketplace, what, you know, at the moment, it's been hard for a lot of startups to get funded and grow. There seems to be a lot of noise around Rubrik, and it's looking good for you guys. But what is it you know, if I was to ask you, what's the differentiation that really makes you stand out? Because it's quite a crowded market all of a sudden. What would you describe that as?
I tend to default to simplicity. as the first and foremost for the design. I mean, there's a lot of consumer tech engineers that work for the company, you know, Google and Facebook and whatnot, that try to take this really complex problem and turn it into a Google search bar to find things and building policy that you have to answer 3 or 4 questions and it's done. Being able to operate the system using almost no time, like we run several of them across the globe, and I think I log into them maybe once every 6 months or so because the policies are so dynamic that it kind of takes care of everything for you. I think that's the big one. But beyond that, like I said, we're not just focused on, or actually very little focus is on the storage piece for the on-prem appliance. You know, it's a very, like, as a startup, you have to bundle those things together and you have to make it super simple so that, like, here's our box, you can buy it, put it in your data center, an hour later you're up. Because you just don't have the support infrastructure and the engineering to try all these different things, you know, with bring your own hardware and whatnot. But there's certainly nothing preventing us from doing that because all the IP's in the software. And that's why I feel like we started with the appliance. We offered a software-only version. We're working with MSPs so they can tether customers to it. But once you have the system in play, you built policies around objects, you can really just decide anywhere you want to put the data without having to be an expert in things like cloud or object store. You know, it's like, give me some keys, give me a bucket, we'll handle it from there. The data is always available. It's always restorable. You know, it's never hidden or in some vault or something that says like, hey, I just have the catalog, but I don't have the data. And it allows you to literally type in a query that is answered kind of in real time in a Google search bar for all the data. So that all bubbles up into simplicity, which I think has been sorely lacking from the data protection market.
When you touched on that, it made me think that perhaps having all of this stuff in one place, having all of the different features and the abilities you can do with the data, the ability to search and to store various different things and dedupe it and make it nice and efficient, that strikes me as a super lock-in type technology, where customers could have been really tied into putting all of their eggs in one basket. Now, I'm not sure that that's the case in your instance, but it strikes me that the market could be like that. But it sounded to me like you said that that's not necessarily the case from the physical perspective, Chris.
Sure. I mean, to be honest, everything has lock-in in some way, shape, or form. I'm locked into my apartment. I can't just, you know, get up and just vacate it anytime I want. There's fees and penalties for that. So that's just life. The ways that I think Rubrik, as an example, removes lock-in is traditionally the vendor's interface to your data is kind of the constraint of how you actually manipulate that data. Like, so if you want to do workload testing for restores, right, you have to go into their tool and use whatever they provide for you for that orchestration layer. Whereas we're saying all the data is available through the API. You can do whatever you want with that. Pick whatever orchestration engine you want. Pick whatever target you want for the data. You can make the changes on that after the fact. You know, all you're really kind of locked in, quote unquote, for us is we're going to be moving the data for you out of the primary system by a way of backup into whatever targets that you want, and we'll own the lifecycle of that data. But everything else, you can just choose to use vRealize or Puppet or Chef or whatever it is that you want. I use PowerShell mostly to control everything about the lifecycle security management of the data. And that's kind of new, right? Traditionally, you're locked into one or more, typically more interfaces, consoles, whatever, for the data protection software and the storage. And you can't leave that world, or you have to learn their specific language and SDK. Where RESTful APIs, I feel like, really changes that game.
I'd agree that the API side of things definitely makes a difference. It's certainly a nicer and easier approach to write to, but obviously, unless everybody's on the same APIs, you're still writing to a particular API for every single person, just like you might have written to the same PowerShell or the same interface. If they're reasonably generic, yeah, I guess you can reuse, and that's always good, but there's always going to be a bit of stuff tied to any one particular platform, I think.
Sure, yeah. Everyone's going to have different endpoints.
I was going to say, it depends how simple the API is. I mean, we've had some experience recently with just swapping. So it's a different use, but NoSQL database is just swapping from Mongo to something different, just to see how quickly you can do it. And as long as the APIs are relatively similar, you can do these things pretty quickly now.
Yeah, for example, you know, you only need to pull out an ID of an object and then the ID of a policy and associate the two. So, I mean, it's very, very simple work. If you want to clone a workload, it's one call. You just say, here's a workload ID. Please make a live mount of that. To retire the live mount, you call a thing that says delete the live mount. So we're talking about 1 to 3 calls to activate pretty much any workflow you can think of. So very, very simple.
And how are customers sharing that with each other, or if they are at all? Because you said, obviously, that's where you spend a lot of your time, getting into that level of detail for the customer. Do you share stuff with other between customers to help them sort of like build their, I guess, library of APIs or API code or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, I'm an open source nerd too. So everything that I can like get away with publishing to GitHub, I do under the Rubrik INC organization page. So all of our PowerShell and vRealize and Python code is there for the most part. There's some stuff that's internal that we give to customers and not just the general public. But that's mostly because the stuff we share open source, we want to make sure it's been vetted and kind of cleaned up and things like that. But Absolutely. I've had a lot of customers that have written integration with ServiceNow and with our help, or at least our advice, and are able to then reuse that amongst each other, as long as we've sanitized it and made sure that the use case is applicable kind of globally. But that's also the nice thing is because they're all so simple, for example, one of our partners that I used to work for, Ahead, actually wrote up a vRealize Orchestrator plugin in like a week, I don't know, and then published it. And they were like, all right, it's good. There's only four or five calls they needed to make. So it was done because most of the complexity is abstracted by the platform. So that all you're really doing is telling it what you want the end result to be, and it'll figure out the process on the front end to do that. So there's not a lot of heavy lifting involved, I guess is the point there. But yeah, they tend to like sharing with one another because there's nothing proprietary or secret in there.
With any of these new sort of environments where we're coming up with API-driven solutions or PowerShell-type things, anything where there's some sort of community where you can share this stuff in a really easy way and obviously not compromising any of your own internal company policies or anything, I think that for me this seems to be one of the best value adds of these sort of solutions is that A, they're enabled to do that because they're API driven, but B, if we've now got the ability to share stuff in a way that we never could in the past.
It's like walking like an Egyptian, Chris. Everybody knows how to do it.
that is true, Martin. That is true. Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Something about cops and donut shops. I don't know the song, but
yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Guys, don't let Monday get too manic on us. Come on, let's move.
Well, it's kind of fun day though, isn't it?
So I'm going to take us down a slightly negative route for a second.
Oh, he's going cynical. Let's do it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's usually my job.
Well, okay, so Martin and I have suffered the hard end of the storage world, and you know we've suffered from bad products that don't work properly, products that got bugs or whatever. If I'm now putting all of my non-production, shall we call it, data into one place, how do I protect against things like software bugs, data corruption, and all the rest of it? Because potentially I've got a huge amount of data that's been heavily deduped and is now spread across a number of scale-out appliances, I guess, in your case. How do I protect against that? Do you build anything into your solution for that?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's part of me cynical. It's just as you are. Like, software is going to have bugs and things like that. Obviously, some advantages that we have is we actually consume the same API that we publish. Like, so the interface and all of the technology between the nodes talk API to one another. So it's not like the API, which we kind of, you know, you can use the interface, but I love using the API, isn't a second-class citizen that's kind of bolt-on, that's, you know, missing features, which means it also gets included in all the regression testing and things like that. But because most of our engineering is from the world of Google and VMware and Facebook and things like that, everything is automatically unit tested. The build process goes through pretty rigorous QA. There's a test team. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into the front end of the product that, as my first time in vendor world, I'm like, this is kind of cool. That was part of why I wanted to join, was see how that's made. But also the architecture itself lends itself pretty well to modularity. So the Rubrik software stack is actually kind of three different layers. There's a file system layer, there's the actual storage layer, and then everything above that is the ecosystem integration layer into various products. So it means that we can innovate and tweak code at those different layers. And it also means that the middle part, which is kind of the logic and the file system layer, doesn't really know about the data that's coming into it. And the storage layer doesn't really know about the files themselves. So there's a lot of abstraction into that, meaning that it's not like there's this one giant blob of waterfall code and once somebody fat fingers that thing, it's all screwed. So there's a lot of intelligence into how the architecture is actually baked. And then the third thing, I suppose, is that most of our customers don't keep a lot of data on the appliance itself. You'll typically make that your, I don't know, 30 to 90-day landing spot for data, and then you'll shuffle it off to some kind of archive, so that'd be public cloud or object store or something along those lines. Because you're just looking for Rubrik to give you that really quick RTO, you know, bring it right back up instantly. I don't have to pull it over the WAN or anything for live mounts and working with the data in real time. So it's not like all your eggs are in the Rubrik appliance basket either. And there's a lot of work from a self-healing perspective. We have a project internally called Forge that actually monitors all the nodes, does the self-healing, all the typical things you would expect for a scale-out, you know, masterless type system.
So it's not going to replace your long-term archive?
No, we don't even advocate that you would use Rubrik for a long-term archive. I mean, that would be pretty expensive, to be honest with you. We typically say, you know, if you got credits in, you know, Azure or AWS, if you've got some object store partners you want to work with, like a Cloudian or a Scality, or we've got a number of those, or if you're just working with an MSP and they're repurposing like an NFS storage, which we also can write to, any of those are just cheap and deep. And we've already handled the dedupe inefficiencies. We actually co-locate all our metadata with the data that we archive. So even if we completely go away, The metadata mapping is associated with the archive data. And that's so we're continuously backing ourselves up to the archive.
I was going to say, have you done any work integration with LTFS and things like that for those idiots who still want to put it for tape?
I personally advocate never to use tape. I'm like, please, no tape. I imagine at some point, you know, maybe we'll have to cross that path and check that box. But the way that I think the most people are using tape because there's some archaic rule that they have to, right? The business said, oh, we got to use tape because it was some technology decision made way long time ago and for financial reasons.
I was going to say, but it's the latter, mostly financial reasons. Yeah. Economically, you still can't beat the price of tape.
Yeah, but in some cases, you can get so close that the value you can get from the data is like, right? So if I've got object stores that are put together really cheap and deep, and we're working with some of them now that are crazy how big they can get for the price point, as considering you're at a 4-to-1 or 6-to-1, data reduction value, now you're talking like some serious value, right? You're talking some serious value. And even they can potentially shuttle that stuff off to tape. So there's even like a multi-tier approach you could do. But I feel like the financial huge driver behind tape is being eroded. And I'm seeing tape vendors kind of saying, I'm tired of doing this sort of thing. I saw one major vendor last year quit manufacturing tapes. Today, no. Maybe someday we'll cross that path.
To go back, so the question I just wanted to ask is, you mentioned a lot of other vendors that you see building out the solution. And it's a bit of an old cliche, but people don't tend to buy storage. They buy a solution stack. Are there other vendors that you're working well with to build, an end-to-end solution? So about handling data management right from primary through secondary into some of this long-term archive? Because you named off a few vendors there. How tight's the integration?
Yeah, like on the front end, some examples I can give you is Pure Storage from a storage perspective. More like an HCI vendor would be Nutanix. And we have designs where we work alongside with those vendors and say, all right, the big one is like a Nutanix is an example. You're going to build this hyper-converged gem of an environment in your data center and then attach this old crusty backup stuff to it. So like, hey, if you're going to do a scale-out kind of HCI-type deployment for your production, why not do a cloud data management to go behind that? That's also scale out shared nothing for those on the front end, and then we have I think something like 14 ecosystem vendors that we can write to on the back end for object, cloud, and file store like NFS, right? And that's pretty straightforward because we have tools that can test their software. We actually instantiate, delete, run all the different commands we need to do for the like the S3 API as an example, just to make sure that they're compliant beyond just saying they have S3 compliant. We actually run through all the tools to make sure that's true.
That's what I meant. People don't want to be the guinea pig. They want to have seen it done somewhere else before that you've proved it. It's not going to go horribly wrong.
Yeah, that's nice because if they want to try something we haven't seen before, we can just say, cool, let's test it. We got this tool. It'll go through all the API calls that we make, try it out, and then we're good from our standpoint. If they pick a vendor that has file system issues underneath that, well, that's can't control that so much, but all the ones that we've officially partnered with are pretty rock solid.
These sort of solutions that we're seeing in terms of their architecture, I think we've touched on a few of them briefly, Chris. So you mentioned a bit about public cloud there. You mentioned a bit about scale out. Typically, for the type of solutions you're putting in, what are customers doing? Are they buying a single unit in a single location? Are they scaling out in one location? Are they building out multiple locations? Are they then immediately going to public cloud? What's like a typical architecture for the way that people would deploy it?
Yeah, good question. Most people buy... you start with a piece of the data center, right? It's tough to say you're going to sweep the floor with everything in day one. And I don't really advise that anyways. That's kind of awesome. Typically buy two appliances, one per site. They have a primary and a secondary site or a DR site or something like that. And the appliance, we call it a brick. It comes with four nodes. So they're going to have four nodes on each site. They can set up either unidirectional or bidirectional replication based on whatever policies they feel are important. And depending if one site is hot and the other one's warm, something along those lines. And then a pretty small number are going to public cloud these days. If you do, you typically have credits, especially the enterprise agreements with the ELAs with Azure make the blob storage really, really attractive because they're handing out like bags of money, like please use. Here's $250,000 worth of tokens for blob store. And it's like, yeah, cool. And because it's all encrypted in flight and at rest, it's relatively low risk, right? Because you're encrypting the whole process to put your backup data in there, just to dip a toe into cloud. But like I said a little bit earlier, most folks are doing anywhere from 2 weeks to maybe 3 months of data on the appliance cluster. maybe replicating and keeping the replicated data on there for 2 weeks to 4 weeks, something like that, for a DR purpose, and then shuffling the remainder to an archive either that's hosted by an MSP, or just kind of a backup as a service type play, or an object store in most cases, and a small number are going to like an S3 or a blob store from Azure.
And what sort of percentage is kept on the appliance? I know you've said sort of like a date range there, but does that then translate into like a typical sort of percentage in any way?
That would be a hard one to answer because it's all over the place, right? It's typically, you know, you'll look, it's kind of driven also by the data, because in some cases, someone will say, yeah, I want 3 months on there. And you'll say, okay, well, you've got this many petabytes of data, so you need this much of a landing target with your dedupe and efficiency ratios. And they say, well, do we really need 3 months? And they'll go back and analyze their restore percentages and say, well, in 7 years, we've never restored anything over 7 days old, you know, so let's just make it 1 month. Right. So it actually is a good time to exercise a little bit of an audit on your restore procedures and figure out what you really need. So it'd probably be a smaller percentage holistically. And that's obviously going to depend on, am I putting 7 years or infinite retention policies on the archive target? Because some of them get crazy, like infinite retention. That just blows my mind. Who's going to need something 100 years from now? Nobody needs
that. Well, do you know what? I used to work in a number of places where we would get told to retain backups indefinitely because we haven't decided what we're going to do with them.
Well, if you look at the pharmaceuticals, I have to.
Yeah.
Yeah, most of my places working on the customer side was indefinite. And that was where the point where, like, we're putting 350 tapes in Iron Mountain every month. Like, how many millions of tapes are in this thing? You know, how do we even restore these things that are 20 years old?
And the interesting thing about that is that you end up with the big negative that causes, and the one thing I think that solutions that are doing secondary storage are fixing, is the fact that you have no metadata to tell you why you kept that. Because nobody ever remembers to write down or record why they kept a tape forever. And even if they did, somebody's forgotten it because the team changes and then it all gets lost. And it's that metadata that becomes the key point of that, I think, in terms of retaining stuff.
Yeah, and you could potentially, you know, with our system, you could query, you know, what's in there, why, when was it stored, do I need it anymore? You could adjust potentially the SLA or the policy to remove some of that. And plus, I think because secondary storage, or in this case Rubrik, the idea is it's globally deduplicated and compressed, and the metadata is kind of mapping that out at scale. I mean, I think we can handle something like 32 exabytes before we start hitting our boundary. So it's going to be good for a while, I assume. Who knows? If there's enough cat videos out there, eventually we're going to need more space. But
I'd have said the average customer should be okay, but you know.
Yeah.
You never know. You never know, do you? Just to tie off on that discussion, what about how as we move to the public cloud more and people run hybrid workloads where they've got stuff running in the public cloud as well as their on-prem stuff? How do you think that will change the way that we look at secondary storage and how, for instance, you might look at it in terms of your platform?
So that's obviously a direction we're going. You start with the big dog. You know, we started with VMware on-premises type deployments. We started with cloud as a target, but the goal is to be able to protect those workloads and then perhaps even go the other way around. A number of customers say, I'm running all these SaaS or kind of cloud applications and I want to back it up into my on-premises data center because I can get really cheap and deep object store or whatever there. So they want to go in the reverse. And those are the avenues that we're looking to explore because that's the, if we're going to call ourselves cloud data management, we have to manage all clouds, at scale. And so the idea is, run services and applications of the Rubrik code in those public clouds and give you the option to go from cloud to cloud or cloud back to on-prem or really any direction you want to go, because we're not married to any of the hardware. Like I said, the storage is largely irrelevant in the equation from a constraint perspective. It's just one option as an architect for designing the system.
We've talked a lot about the different technologies, how they work, a lot of the benefits and so on. If you're an end customer or an end user listening to us, what would you recommend as a way to go in terms of evaluating their need for secondary storage and how they would do a proof of concept? How would they go about actually evaluating their need and putting a solution in?
That's the beauty of the new age of technology, right? It's supposed to be very frictionless and easy. And if it's not, why are you even looking at it? So putting the box in for proof of concept, it's about an hour. It typically takes longer to eat lunch than it does to get the system. And I'm talking about an hour from it's a box in my data center, cardboard box, to it's running and taking backups, and now I can restore from them. So it's pretty short. I'd recommend work with your team to figure out what your end goals are and try to remove the constraints out of your mind of this is what we have today and this is what we can do. Think of what you want it to do and then marry that up with a proof of concept.
Do you find that's a problem, Chris?
Yeah, most architects are like, oh, this is what I could do today, and that's what the system has to be able to fit into, or that's the only thing I can do as an architect. And I feel like, as a consultant, it was all about what is your desired state? If you could have anything and no constraints were in place, what would it look like? And then how much of that reality can you bring to the table? And that's where it's not just about ingest speeds and data set sizes and just storage stuff. Like, what do you actually want to do with all these things? And do you want to free up some of that time to learn, you know, code, automation, things like that? That's my personal like passion. But going back to, you know, getting more grounded to like a POC, it's really just a matter of what are you looking to protect? What do you want to start with? And potentially, if you're able to show the team, hey, I could bring up services and applications in 30 seconds or something like that, would that offer value? What can we do with that? And show that off to the team. That's typically where you can kind of become a champion internally for your IT team, you know, being able to do things that you've never been able to do before. Heck, some of the times people are running a proof of concept, they're protecting up production workloads just to test it. Like, they're running in parallel the old backup system and then us, because, you know, if they don't end up buying, they have to make sure they have those backups. There's a catastrophic issue. I can remember a couple times where there was a catastrophic issue in the production and the whole service goes down and they're like, well, we got this rubric thing in here, let's press the button. And we bring up the service in like 30 seconds or something like that, the full VM is back online, and everyone's like, how did you do that? They're like, rubric. I was like, yeah, you're now the hero, man. So I hope your stuff doesn't go down while you're POCing, but it's also kind of an added bonus.
So I think what you're saying is really a lot of this is about being creative and thinking about what you want to achieve rather than necessarily anything to do about how the technology works, which is a different approach for a lot of technology focused people who tend to like talking about speeds and feeds and connectivity and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, our sales engineers know all that day-to-day stuff and can get you the, you know, what the port speeds are and things like that, but quite frankly, the business and the app owners don't really care for the most of the details. I mean, I do. I'm a nerd. I have a whole lab running off, you know, to my left over here with just all the stuff that I built, and it's fun. But at the same time, it's like no one actually cares if you have 25 gigabit or 20 gigabit or whatever the heck it is in the data center. They just want to know, if I want to bring up an application, how fast can you do that for me? And how much work do I have to do as the app owner to make that a reality? If you can make that really, really simple for them, or not even a problem for them, they don't have to think about it, and they can bring up services in seconds or something like that. To me, that's a much more interesting conversation than various bits and bytes.
So, Chris, one more thing, because we asked this of a lot of companies. What's next for Rubrik? Where do you guys get growth from? Because, you know, it's a highly competitive market. Is it going to be about new territories? Is it going to be about new products? Without going into details and asking you to give us our roadmap, where do you go from here?
Yeah, here's our roadmap. Beep. No, I was just censoring myself. Yeah, I mean, just a quick kind of shout out. You know, we over the last 12 months, we've seen a growth of 7x for the company from a customer, you know, number of customers coming in perspective. So people are gravitating towards it for the kind of obvious reasons, like cheaper, faster, that kind of thing. But also the less obvious, like, I don't have to deal with my backup system anymore, and I spend, you know, a few minutes a week instead of a day a week, something like that. I think the future is more around the things that I tend to advocate, such as, you know, what does your cloud strategy look like? How are you trying to get out of being a data center management company and into, you know, focusing on your core business? And that's where I feel like it's more of an interesting conversation to talk around that and potentially bring Rubrik into the conversation than it is to just be like, buy my stuff. So a lot of the customers that I'm talking with, it's, all right, what are you going to do for on-prem? How are you going to tie that into cloud? And then how can we get Rubrik in there to help you? You know, so it's protecting all of those newer kind of workloads in addition to some of the legacy workloads. Like, we protect physical boxes, we protect SQL databases, things along that nature. But what are we going to do around containers? What are we going to do around various hypervisors? What are we going to do around, you know, dynamic workloads that are instantiated and deleted in, you know, minutes or something like that? And how do we shuffle that data both kind of at rest into cloud and object store vendors, you know, outside your data center? Co-located data centers, MSPs, things like that. How do we instantiate those workloads into those environments? So for people that are looking to do potentially on-prem VMware and then shuffle some of that out to like a Hyper-V somewhere or a EC2, something along those lines. And then how do we get the data between those different environments? Right. So it's an iterative process. You start with on-prem, you start with VMware, you keep adding to it, and then the focus is keep focusing more on those cloud workloads, what's actually going to happen in the cloud. And cloud, I mean generically, right? It could be hosted or public, or it doesn't have to be Amazon. And how do we make that control?
I'm hearing solution stacks. Yeah, you're gonna do the stuff for the difficult
but
stuff
at the same
for
time,
other people.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's all the same policy. Like, everything that we brought in, the part that I feel is most integral to this is the policies that you generate with those three or four questions apply globally, right? You can apply it to a database, a server, an instance, a VM. It doesn't matter. You're just asking questions of the system, or it's asking you questions like, how long do you want to keep the data, where you want to put it? And then it's solving all the abstraction for you, right? So I think that's key, so that you can just you can build a system that you always interact with kind of the same way. It's that same simple ask a couple questions, get a couple answers that applies globally. That's key. You don't have to learn all these little nooks and crannies at a technical depth that is just crazy. You'd have to have all these team members to do. So I think that's the simplicity message I talked about earlier at scale across different cloud environments that we're looking to reinforce and help our customers with.
This has been a great conversation, Chris. Thanks very much for spending the time to chat to us today. You've got a great badass T-shirt on, I see. And for the audience, they can't see it. And I'm actually wearing, without any sort of prompting, I am actually wearing my Rubrik fleece, which...
You're so shallow, Chris.
I know, it's terrible, isn't it? Which are very comfortable and nice.
My mind control is working.
Exactly. Obviously working really well. But thanks for joining us. It's been really useful to start with a primer and get people understanding what some of the issues here are in understanding what is, well, we'll call it secondary storage for now, but clearly is a lot more than that. Perhaps we can get you back to get down into some of the depths another time and go a bit technical into the real depths next time, because I think that could give us some really interesting discussions. Well, anyway, thanks very much. Thanks for joining us. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And if you want to catch us online, you can get us at storageunpacked.com. You can get us at storageunpacked on Twitter. And I think I said every week we have some sort of LinkedIn page, which is a horrible link I can never remember, but you can catch us there. As usual, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.